Hey, everyone. I'm Amy Standen, Ear Hustle's editor.
And I'm Rahsaan New York Thomas, Ear Hustle producer. And do you believe, Amy, they left us alone to kick off the fundraiser?
We better not blow it, Rahsaan. The stakes are high.
We're going to blow it. We just have to find new jobs, I guess. This is the second Ear Hustle fundraiser I've been here for, and I never knew how much the show relies on listener support.
It really, really does. From now through the end of this season in June, our goal is to reach 1,000 donors.
So, Amy, for folks who donate, should we tell them where that money goes?
Sure. These donations help fund our ongoing work, but also things like getting us into prisons where we've never been before. Like if you enjoyed our episode about the hospice program at CMF, or the ones we've done with the women we've been meeting at the world's largest women's prison, CCWF. And there's also some really cool behind-the-scenes stuff, like developing an Ear Hustle curriculum for high school teachers.
Listener donations support all of that. Plus, this year, supporters will be invited to join us for a virtual party on June 13th, and they get a playlist of songs picked by the team.
And everyone who donates $10 a month or more will get access to Ear Hustle Plus, which is our new subscription service with ad-free episodes and bonus content.
Find out more and donate at earhustlesq.com.
Listener support means so much to us. Thank you. Should we give the mic back to Nigel Nerland now?
Not yet. We just got it.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds.
You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This episode contains language that may not be appropriate for all listeners. There's also a reference to suicide. Discretion is advised.
How many women are incarcerated here?
I think around 800.
So everybody know everybody.
Everybody knows everybody,
or pretty
everybody
much. Know everybody business.
Exactly that.
Is there a lot
they
of gossip
know more
here?
About you than you know about yourself.
Is there a lot of gossip here?
A lot. All the time.
Do you think it's more gossip in the women's prison or the men's prison?
The women's, for sure. For sure.
I don't know.
I didn't know men gossip so much until I started hanging out in San
Quentin. See,
oh, my God.
They know a lot about you. And with that, you don't even know. You find out a lot about yourself in here through other people, through the rumors on the yard.
I'm Nigel Poor.
And I'm Earline Woods. And this is Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
On this episode, a story from the California Institution for Women,
a prison about an hour east of Los Angeles.
And you identify who you are?
Yes, I'm Karen Honeycutt.
Okay.
And how long have you been incarcerated?
It'll be 12 years in January.
Were you this glamorous when you stepped inside 12 years ago?
I'd like to think so.
Wait, when you say glamorous, what, can you explain a little bit more, I hope.
Can you
explain this, Nigel? Yes.
Well, okay, so she's got on beautiful blue eyeshadow that matches the sparkle of the kind of crystally earrings. And then she's got blue hoops on, so like the color goes from her eye down to her ear. But it's her hair. So it's a couple different colors. It's gray.
It definitely has gotten gray.
Blonde, but it's very short and stylish. It's kind of the short haircut of the year. It's the haircut I wish I could have, but I can't. Anyway, I think she looks great.
Earline, it was interesting. Karen really stood out because she was like so sparkly and vivacious. And I'm not just talking about her physical presentation.
Right.
Like the whole thing about her was
right.
Bright.
I mean, yeah, I mean, in a spot like that, you know, where it's hella hot, the mood of the place is kind of stuffy, and I mean, it just seems like it just take all the oomph about you.
Yeah, it just seemed like everything was sort of flatlined there.
Right.
And she was the opposite of that.
She was like, I don't care where I'm at, I'm gonna live to the best of my ability.
Yeah, and so seeing her with her hair and her makeup, all of that, it didn't strike me as vanity. It seemed like it was more act of like self-preservation,
right,
and resilience. Okay.
Right, we'll cut right into it.
So we heard an interesting story about you. I heard that you helped someone give birth in a cell.
That's correct. So I was in the cell alone. And then they brought in this girl who was about seven and a half months pregnant. Little tiny thing. You know, you could barely tell she was pregnant. One afternoon, she started having pains in her stomach. So we called, you know, for the nurse. They sent her to medical and sent her back and said, you just need to drink more water. Probably a half hour later or so, she gets up to go to the restroom. I'm, you know, helping her and talking to her. She rises up from the toilet and grabs her stomach, you know, like, like she was in a lot of pain. And I looked over and you really couldn't miss it. She had stood up. The head was crowning. So I knew something was going to happen pretty quick.
And then, so did you like escort her over to the bunk?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
What did you say to her? Do you remember?
I told her it was going to be all right, that I'm here and that I would help her and everything's going to be okay. And that's about all I could say because it wasn't much time.
Was she scared?
I think I was more scared than she was, maybe. But, you know, again, I was kind of, I don't want to say out of it, but I was medicated and, you know, kind of groggy and all of this. So it didn't really dawn on me what was happening. I think my instinct just set in and I did what I thought was the right thing to do. I knew it wasn't time for anybody to get there to help her. I had her lay down and told her when she had a contraction, you got to push, the baby's coming. She probably pushed two times and the baby came right out, little teeny tiny girl, and came out screaming. So I think she was not quite happy that she was being born in a jail cell. When the baby came out, we had nothing but a prison towel hanging on the bunk. So I grabbed the towel and wrapped the baby up and laid it on her mother's chest. And one of the porters were out cleaning. She had ran to the door because she heard the screaming and all of that. And so she let the officers know when almost as soon as the baby came and I put her on her mom's chest, they rushed in and took her off and, you know, did all they could do.
Must have been such a weird noise, like you don't hear babies crying
right
in prison.
Right. Well, everybody was talking about it the next day, and that all of a sudden they hear a baby, you know, something that's absolutely not a noise that you hear in jail. The medical brought a cart in for her. And they took the mom and baby together because, you know, the umbilical cord and everything hadn't been cut. None of that had happened at that time. So they took them off together. And then she came back the next day. And, of course, they, you know, they took the baby. And her mom has had to raise the baby because she's was sentenced to life in prison. After everything had been said and done, one of the officers came in and told me that I should be proud of myself and that my family would be proud of me, too, for what I did. And I just couldn't even fathom the thought. I couldn't even conceive of why would they be proud. My emotions were blunted. In other words, I just really couldn't feel what somebody normally would feel. I just really went through the motions.
This all happened in the county jail. A week later, Karen was transferred to prison.
About a year later, she came up there to where I was, and so we were able to reconnect there.
Did you recognize her?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
She's kind of distinguished. And of course, you know, with the accent, I'm pretty recognizable too.
In that week, did anything change between you two? Because that's such an intimate experience.
Yeah, you know, we talked a lot, and it was definitely a bonding experience. And, you know, I was there to comfort her and let her know that everything was going to be okay. She was really worried because the baby was born small. She found out pretty quickly, you know, that everything was going to be okay. And she's a beautiful little girl.
Have you ever helped anyone before?
No.
And have you ever seen it from that perspective? I mean, I know you're a mom, but so what did that change for you?
Not at all.
Did it make you think of things about your own?
You know, kind of not at the time. I really never spoke about it in the beginning. I never told my parents. I never, you know, really told any of my family until probably a year later. When I was able to kind of deal with what I had going on too, and me obtaining a life sentence and having to leave my children and all of that, it kind of gave me a different perspective on things, because I caused the death of someone. And to be able to bring life back into the world, it kind of put things into perspective for me in a much different way. I see my situation a lot differently.
So this was kind of an odd moment in the interview, because I know we could both sense there was some kind of backstory,
right?
Something she wasn't quite telling us, right? That she was hinting at. And I just didn't know if it was time to push her a little bit, you know, especially because we've made it very clear that we don't ask people about their crimes unless it's related to the story.
Right, right.
And at this point, I really wasn't sure.
Yeah, I mean, when she brought up the fact that she had been given a life sentence, of course, my mind started trying to figure out, like, why. So I think when she said that, it was like a opening just to inquire.
Just curious, how do you grapple, or is that the word? How do you grapple with a life sentence?
Oh, that's a much different story. I'm kind of different in the reasoning behind. I'm here for gross vehicular manslaughter, and it was my 9-year-old daughter that was killed. And at the time, all I wanted to do was die. For me, being sentenced to life was kind of some weird poetic justice. That's how I felt about it. I wanted nothing more than for my daughter to be okay and to live, and here I am sentenced to life. I thought with my addiction that it would kill me and that would be the worst thing that could possibly happen. And it's so far from the worst thing that could possibly happen. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that.
I don't know do we want to get into this or not? I mean, I know it's off topic.
Yeah.
I don't think this comes across on the tape, but when she said that, I was so unprepared. I was trying to stall for time. I actually turned to our editor and was like mouthing, what do we do?
Yeah, those be hard moments. Like, what is the next question? Because you wasn't really, it just throws you.
Oh my God. And Erlon, it happened so fast. You know, that's what it's kind of interesting what happens when you go into an interview and you think one thing is going to happen, and then you're told something that is so painful and raw,
right,
and gut-wrenching, but you still have to be there and do the interview.
Right.
Oh, I was so glad I wasn't there alone.
Definitely. The accident took place in 2011. Karen was a real estate agent, married, with 4 kids. She was driving with 3 of them in a car when she lost control and crashed into a tree. Karen's 2 sons survived, but her daughter Chloe was killed. When the cops tested Karen's blood alcohol level, it was 3 times the legal limit.
I thought that I was in control of everything and managing everything. You know, there was food on the table, the bills were paid, you know, we great vacations and all of that. You couldn't convince me otherwise. But the only time I liked myself was when I was drinking. We'd go to, you know, 2 martini lunch or whatever it would be. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody did. but when I drink, I don't know what the outcome is going to be. So, you know, that's where I differ from other people. One of the clinicians that I work with told me one day, she said, okay, well, you control when you drink. Okay, I got it. You can go for 2 weeks, a month, whatever, and not have a drink. I'm like, yeah, okay, this lady's agreeing with me. But then she says, but what happens after you take that first drink? Then I'm completely out of control. And that's how it's always been. I protected my children from everybody but myself. That was a very hard thing to come to terms with. As much as I love them, I put them in the most dangerous, horrifying situation that anyone ever could, because they loved me and they trusted me, and all of that was broken. From the beginning, I knew that I didn't want my children and my ex-husband to go through a trial and any of that. So I tried to plead guilty to the first thing that they gave me, and they started off with life without parole. I didn't think that I was going to live through it anyway. I thought the pain that I was in was going to kill me. I didn't think anybody could survive it. It didn't really matter to me how much time they gave me.
Did no one give you advice at the trial, or you just weren't listening?
They did give me advice when they were first going to sentence me. I just didn't care. I told them, just plead guilty, I don't care, and they wouldn't do it. They said no. And then finally the DA agreed to a 19 to life sentence, and I've done 12 of that. When I figured out that I'm really not gonna die, I had to decide to just try to do the best I can while I'm incarcerated, be the mother that I claimed to be, but wasn't all the time. My children, you know, they know how much I love them. They knew how much I love them. So it was very difficult for them. I had to work on being the person that they knew me to be, not the person that took the life of their sister, because they know how much I loved her too.
I mean, do you mind talking about
not at all,
this?
Not at all.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I just want to ask this because I'm just personally very curious.
Absolutely.
So I have a grandson, and I often have these fantasies, not good ones, that something will happen to him while I'm taking care of him.
Yeah.
And I think I could never live with it.
Yeah.
And even if I didn't intentionally cause it, and I have nightmares about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So how, when something like that does happen,
mm-hmm.
how do you get your mind around it? How do you go on? I mean, I know you said you didn't think you would live, and I can understand that feeling.
Yeah.
How, what is the process of that?
For a long time, I couldn't even say my daughter's name. I couldn't talk about her at all.
Yeah.
I couldn't talk about her without crying, without completely breaking down. If I heard her name, you know, it, and all of a sudden it's all over everywhere, the radio, the TV, everybody's all of a sudden named Chloe. Chloe was my daughter's name. It took a long time. It took a long time, and probably in the last 4 years out of the 12 I've been incarcerated, I've been able to come to a different place.
Well, now I'm thinking about the original reason we wanted to talk to you, and like how absolutely bizarre that you, as you said, brought this baby mm-hmm. into the world, and all that other stuff was going on in your head.
Yeah.
I mean, I never imagined that's what was going on in your head when you said you were in a difficult place because of your situation. And now I understand why you didn't tell your family right away either, because I would think that would be the first thing you would do, is like, this amazing thing happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They knew I was suicidal. They knew I didn't want to live, and they medicated me because of that. When I would stand up, sometimes I would go into seizures because of the medication. I was pretty much a zombie. I didn't care about doing my hair or my makeup, didn't care about eating or hygiene or, you know, anything. I just did not care. This girl comes in and I'm just like, oh, just, you know, another person coming through. Coming, going, coming, going, coming, going. But then she started sharing with me some of the things that she was going through. And, you know, kind of roommates kind of do that. We tell each other, you know, what are you in here for? I just didn't feel like I could be any use or any help to anybody. But yet I still wanted to comfort her. There's no way that you can think that, okay, I'm getting ready to for this baby's coming. I would have had no idea, and I wouldn't have been really aware of it had she not really fully brought it to my attention with her screams of pain. I think that the reality of the situation did not hit me for quite a while. It was just like, you know, drinking a cup of coffee, honestly. It was just something that happened, and it just, okay, and now let's, you know, I went back to my reality.
Were you irritated that they put a pregnant woman in with you?
I wasn't. I was happy that they put her in with me instead of someone else. Okay.
So it didn't feel like a rebuke or a taunt or...
No. Okay. No. Had it not been for, you know, the blunting of emotions, it may have. But, yeah. You know, at that time, I was barely able to formulate a decent thought.
I'm just imagining if you hadn't been on meds and you were holding that baby, what that would have been
I've thought about that, too. To take a life and then to have a brand new first person to ever touch this life. I mean, wow, it was just so profound, but it was a delayed profound. I feel extremely blessed, and I feel like that was part of the big scheme of things. I don't know, maybe, you know, there's a give and take. Mm-hmm.
Erlen, we've done a few interviews where people's crimes were so heavy and created loss for so many people, including themselves. And I think that, you know, they do a lot of work and they move forward. But I'm going to be honest with you here.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some crimes that break you and you're never going to come back from it.
Yeah.
Or incidents like this.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I hear you. I hear you. You know, I can guarantee you that every night before she go to sleep, her daughter pops up in her head.
Yeah.
Every day when she wake up, that's the first thought. You can't get past that. You ain't gonna never get past that.
And reliving the choice you made.
Yeah. You never get past that.
You must say to yourself every fucking day, if only.
So at this point, you can say her name and talk about her.
Yes.
And you don't feel like just overwhelmed?
You know, the burden that I carry is never going to change, but my ability to carry it has.
Do you feel the fact that you're, I don't know how to say this, not that you've moved on, but you've come to some kind of understanding about
yes.
what happened. Do you ever feel judged by people? Like they want you to just always live in pain?
You know, not really in here, honestly. They see the tragedy of the situation and that it wasn't intentional, regardless of the mistakes I made and the mistake I made. I made the choice to drink and drive and have my children in the car. but as far as being judged, no, not so much.
I can imagine that. No sentence that you would have been handed down
ever
can,
ever.
You know, be more.
They can parole me when I go to board. They can give me a parole date, but this is something I'll never parole from.
You said that you don't feel judged in here. I am very curious if that will be different when you're outside, how people will view it.
Yeah,
I don't know if you have anything to say that, but I wonder.
And yeah, I do too. I do know it was a very highly publicized situation. media and in the papers and everything, and a lot of people had a lot of terrible things to say. It was very hard at the beginning, but I know now that they can only judge me by what they know about me, yeah. And what they know about me is this one thing.
Yeah.
Some days are better than others, but there's never a birthday or Christmas or special days that we had and special times that we had together that I don't think about. You know, they ask us what our fear is of paroling. There's nothing in prison, nothing about prison or anything in here that she belongs to, that she should be a part of. But I know when I get out, I will have to drive down the same street that the wreck happened. I will have to go past the stores where we used to have mother-daughter lunches and get our nails done and all of that. So that's something that I'm going to have to face when I get out there. She's there 1,000 times a day. Little things, it's somebody's name or somebody talking about their daughter. I think about what she would be doing at 21 years old, what she would be like, how she would look, all of those things. She's the last thing I think about every night and the first thing I think about every morning.
Yeah, I was wondering, when you dream about her, is she...
She's still 9.
She's still 9.
Her name is Chloe Adara, and loosely translated, it means beautiful flower. And a lot of times I dream about her in a field of flowers, and she runs up and comes and sits by me. And, oh, Mom, it's okay. And, you know, that's my comfort. Yeah. That's my comfort.
Mm-hmm. I noticed you have a tattoo.
Yes.
What is that?
It's a, well, there's a scar there.
Oh.
And so it's a feather with birds flying out of it. And the writing said, "Everything I loved was taken away from me, and I did not die."
Yeah, so I'm imagining what that scar is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you hold it out so I can describe it?
Yes.
So it's a feather that goes from her wrist almost up to her elbow, and where the feathers would come out of, where that kind of plasticky part of a feather is actually a very long scar that goes up vertically. So a serious attempt there. And then it looks like there's birds that are flying out of the feather. Like they're a part of the feather, but now they're going up and they're free. And then there's the what she said written around it on the inside of her forearm. So something you see every day when you look down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Nigel, are you assuming that came as an attempt, or are you assuming... Or did it come from the accident?
It's one or the other.
It wasn't from the accident.
Yeah, it looks, I mean, that's seems like a
serious attempt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is not where I thought this interview was going.
I'm sorry I got you guys
No, thank you. Anytime
you sit down and talk about something,
you never know. Yeah, this is true.
I appreciate you being willing to talk about it.
I wash my hands in dirty water. I guess this is what I get. It's raining from a clear blue sky. Hasn't hit me yet. And yesterday is a memory, like my dreams is dead and gone. I'm looking through these prison bars, trying to carry on. And if I could
I surely would go back and change the past. But wishing doesn't do any good when time rolls by so fast. I traded in my youth for these prison blues. I guess it was my first mistake. Spent the love of my family, caused so much heartache. And yesterday just fades like a rose when summer's gone. I'm looking through these prison bars, trying to carry on. Oh, if I could, I surely would go back and change the past. But wishing doesn't do any good when time rolls by so fast. And yesterday fade like a rose when summer's gone. I'm looking through these prison bars, trying to carry on. Oh, I'm looking through these prison bars, carry on.
Hey, what's up, Notch?
Hey.
How you doing?
All right.
How you feeling?
Oh, I thought my voice would be back by now, but evidence says otherwise.
I thought we was playing you in fast speed or slow speed or
slow
one.
Slow speed. But we can still do the credits, right?
Of course. People accept you how you are, Nigel.
You're very kind, my friend. All right, let's jump in. Ear Hustle is produced by me, Nigel Poor, Erlon Woods, Amy Standen, and Bruce Wallace, with help from Neroli Price, Rasan New York Thomas, Rashid Zinneman, and Tony Tafoya.
This episode was sound designed and engineered by me, Erlon Woods, with help from Fernando Aruda.
It features music by Antoine Williams, E. Phil Phillips, and David Jossi. And special shout out and thanks to Richie Morris and Quentin Blue for their song, Trying to Carry On. Erlon, I can never get enough of that one.
Nah, that's a deep one right there. Amy Standen edits our show. Shubnam Sigmund is our managing producer. And Bruce Wallace is our executive producer, a.k.a. Mr. Executive Producer.
Ear Hustle would like to thank Lieutenant Newborg, Acting Chief Deputy Warden Lewis, Acting Warden Core, and TV Specialist Mr. Mom at the California Institution for Women.
A special shout out to Deputy Press Secretary Terry Thornton, who over the seasons has been a huge help with many of the questions that come up when we're working on episodes. Congratulations on your retirement, and thank you so much. We'll definitely miss you.
Thanks to Warden Ron Broomfield. And, okay, usually at this point in the credits, we say, as you know, every episode of Ear Hustle
has to be approved by this cat here.
But E, this is a big day.
Da-da-da-da. Yes, it is.
Whenever you guys are ready. Do re mi fa so, do re mi fa so.
Is this what you have to do?
Do re mi. Come on.
No, I'm not doing any of that. I'm not doing any of that.
Oh.
All right, so walk me through this.
Just roll with me.
All right.
Ear Hustle listeners, our friend Lieutenant Robinson has some news to share.
Well, folks, I've had the opportunity to weigh in for 10 seasons now and close out each episode of Ear Hustle as Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the public information officer at San Quentin State Prison. Well, December 31st of this year, I get the opportunity to retire, and I have handed off the best job in the entire California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to my successor, Lieutenant GMR Berry, who is now the public information officer at San Quentin State Prison. I think it's appropriate as we finish our season with an episode from the women's facility that I handed off to my successor, who is a she, who will bring a different voice to the closing of the podcast as they move into season 11 through 20. So you got another 10 seasons ahead of you, Miss Lady. So I will not say that I approve this episode this time, folks. That belongs to Lieutenant Berry. And so, folks, I introduce you to Lieutenant Berry.
Thanks. I am Lieutenant Giamare Berry, and I approve this episode.
So go ahead and do it again. I am Lieutenant GMR Berry, the new public information officer at San Quentin State Prison. Be yourself. Be yourself.
You know, I don't talk much. I'm not saying.
You will now.
All right. Are we rolling? I am Lieutenant GMR Berry, the public information officer here at San Quentin State Prison, and I approve this episode.
Do you take it over from me? Do you take this baby of mine?
Lord.
Yes, there were eye rolls, folks. You can see her.
Yes.
Thank you, guys, and Godspeed to all of you.
We'll be hearing a lot more from Lieutenant Berry, and I'm really looking forward to spending more time with her and getting to know her better. But Earlonne, Sam's retiring is a really big deal for the show.
Yeah, I mean, he's been with us since the beginning.
Yep, and honestly, Ear Hustle wouldn't exist without his care and support. And I'm sad about his leaving. I'm really going to miss him.
But Nige.
Yeah?
He's only retiring. He will be back. This is not the last we're hearing from Sam.
That is probably true. And listeners, stay tuned for a bonus episode in early January that's going to be all about Sam.
But this is really the last episode of our 10th season.
I know. And you know, the end of a season always makes me feel just a little bit melancholy. Truly.
Okay. Well, let's cheer you up by talking about what we got planned for our next season.
I like that idea. So, we've got some great stuff planned for season 11. We're going to be talking more about the experience of being pregnant in prison and also investigating a really important topic, aging inside.
We're going into level 4 prisons for the first time. Maximum security.
Okay, Earlonne, this is actually my first time hearing that. So, this is exciting news.
I'm breathing this into existence, Nigel.
Okay. And, of course, we'll be telling stories from San Quentin.
And we've got some cool collaborations coming up with some of our favorite podcasts.
Yep, that is new territory for us. Very cool.
Indeed. We'll be back with Season 11 the first week in March. But in the meantime, you can keep up with the show by subscribing to our newsletter, The Lowdown, at earhustlesq.com/newsletter.
And of course, you can keep up with us on all the socials at earhustlesq.
This episode was made possible by the Jess Trust, working to amplify the voices, vision, and power of communities that are transforming the justice system.
Ear Hustle is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. Radiotopia is a collection of independent, listener-supported podcasts.
Some of the best podcasts around. To hear more, go to radiotopia.fm. I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor.
Thanks for listening.
And listeners, we're really going to miss you. Happy holidays all around.
Indubitably.
You look like Nigel. You dress like Nigel.
I know. I thought my voice would be way better by this time.
Yeah, you told me that too.
Yeah, I know. It still sounds
You be all right, though. You got some good breasts coming up.
That sounded like you said breasts.
Did I? It's Erlon.
And Nigel.
Here again, reminding you to donate to our spring fundraiser today so we can keep bringing you more Ear Hustle.
Everyone who donates will be invited to our virtual party on June 13th. If you've never been, it's a fun time where we talk about the season and answer some of your questions live. Uncensored, live.
And I will be on the hologram so y'all can see me.
3DE.
On Zoom. Every donation, any amount, will help us reach our goal. So please go to earhustlesq.com to learn more and please contribute.
Thank you.
If you can find it in your heart, in your pocket, in your wallet, in the couch.
Radiotopia.